We've all played the game. What would you do if you won the lottery or inherited a huge sum of money? It actually happened to Mort Zachter, who grew up poor but learned when he was in his 30s that relatives had been hoarding millions of dollars. He tells us what happened in a memoir called Dough. The book is published by the University of Georgia Press, and I'm pleased it has brought Mort Zachter to the show today. Hello.
Hi, Leonard. Nice to be here.
And the title has a double meaning.
Yes, it means both bread and money.
When did your family open the 9th Street Bakery?
The 9th Street Bakery began in 1926. They had actually been located at the corner of Allen and Stanton Street further downtown shortly after World War I. In 1926, Robert Moses, one of his projects was to widen Allen Street to put in a public works project, and then they moved the bakery up to 9th Street between 1st and 2nd, and it is still there to this day.
An East Village institution.
Yes.
Many people will know the bakery. A bakery that doesn't bake its own stuff.
That's right. In the 20th century, early on, immigrants would make their living in what they would call commission bakeries, which was very simply you would buy wholesale from large commercial bakeries in Brooklyn like Pector's or Danilaus or RK, and then you would sell it for a 1 or 2 penny markup in the bakery retail over the counter.
Who created the store? Your grandparents?
My grandparents started the bakery. They were immigrants. They came in 1913 from Russia.
And then when did it pass on to your uncles, Harry and Joe?
They probably kind of from an early age were working in the bakery in the 1920s. They started to work there.
But not your father?
Not my father. This is on my mother's side of the family. My mother worked in the bakery as well. She graduated from Hunter College. She wanted to be a teacher, but my grandfather died in 1937, and she went back to work in the bakery full time.
Did she resent having worked there?
I think that to some extent she did. She would have liked a different career. She loved to teach, and she went back to be a substitute teacher, and she got a lot of pleasure out of that. Even went back when she was in her 40s and got a master's degree from Hunter College.
Wasn't she once held up at gunpoint in the store? That
yes, that
couldn't have made her very happy.
No. That's one of the stories that was passed down, and apparently a robber came into the store. My mother was there. It was late at night. They were waiting for my Uncle Harry to come back. Uncle Joe was the only other one in the bakery. And this gentleman took out a gun, and my mother called for my uncle. And the famous story, as my mother tells it, is when she called for Uncle Joe in the back, he said, "Give the guy some cake." And he shortly came out and realized he had to give him some cash. And the bottom line of the story is it turns out that the police actually arrested someone. The attorney general subpoenaed my uncle to come testify, but he ignored the subpoena. He was too busy working. He couldn't stop working. And a couple of years later, this same gentleman came back to the store to thank my uncle for not testifying against him and said that he had been redeemed. He was now had a job, and he thanked him, and he left with cake.
But this also suggests that your uncles were workaholics.
Yes, they were. My Uncle Joe would get to the bakery at 6 or 7 o'clock in the morning, and they would basically be there until whenever the cake and bread ran out or midnight, whichever came first. Yes, they were, you could say, workaholics.
Did they ever marry?
No. They were never married. They, as my mother would say, they were married to the store.
Were they nice guys? Did you
yes,
like them?
Yes. Of the two, my Uncle Harry was the more personable. He always had a joke to tell. Sometimes I'd even understand the joke when I was a little kid growing up. They could be kind of racy at times, but he always had a sense of humor, and I really loved him. Uncle Joe, he was a bit more cranky. He had phlebitis, so he was a little bit physically more impaired, and that kind of made him upset. And he really would have rather been in synagogue praying. He was a religious man, and he used to sneak away to the 6th Street Synagogue every morning for morning prayer.
What part of New York did you grow up in, not the East Village?
No, I grew up in Brooklyn in the Midwood, between Midwood and Sheepshead Bay section of Brooklyn. That's where I grew up.
But in a rather modest situation.
Right, a modest situation. I grew up, it was a one-bedroom apartment. My parents slept in the bedroom. I slept in the dinette with my head next to the refrigerator.
On a cot?
No, we had a bed. We had a bed. There was no door, but it was just immediately adjacent to the kitchen, and that's where how I grew up. But, you know, at the time, I was happy. This isn't a Jewish version of Angela's Ashes in that I always had what to eat, I had what to wear, but they were modest upbringings, and then when I found out about all this, it kind of made me wonder.
Well, you didn't think of yourself as poor, you're saying.
No, I had a happy childhood. I grew up, I played ball on the street, I had my friends, we had a Zenith black and white TV, and my mother brought chocolate lace cookies home once a week from the bakery.
And what about your uncles? Did they live any better?
No, they probably lived worse off. They drove around for years in an Oldsmobile that had been rear-ended on the Williamsburg Bridge and looked like a giant accordion. They went to the NYU Dental School for many years because that was a low-cost way of getting health care.
Well, what did your uncles and your parents think money was for then?
It's a good question. I think within the family, there was a Depression-era mentality. It was something, I guess, in my uncle's. My uncle Harry was really the controlling one within the family, and I guess within his mind there must have been some kind of pathos there to just not enjoy himself and keep this and not even let his sister get paid.
So she was working free.
She could bring home whatever cake or cookies or whatnot she could bring home, and she always brought me chocolate lace cookies.
Did your parents know how much money this business was generating?
I would say it was, yes, they did. My father was an attorney and he worked as a senior claims examiner in an unemployment insurance office, but he was very close with my uncles and understood all this going back when my uncles passed away. So my father had done real estate closing for my uncles when they sold their house on Hegeman Avenue in Brooklyn, and they moved back to the Lower East Side in the mid-60s, and they had been aware of it. I think my mother was aware they had a lot of money. She might not have known how much, but she was aware.
Well, your mother once blurted out at a Rosh Hashanah gathering, "My Morton doesn't like money."
Yes. What does that mean? Yes, that's what that was her saying. I think it was that you could basically have your needs met, but wants were out of the question.
And once your Uncle Harry declared, if we had invested in real estate, we would be rich. Do you think he was joking?
I think he was saying that it would have been a lot easier way to make a living in his mind if they had invested in real estate. The famous story in the family was that for years and years they knew the man who was the chief real estate appraiser in the city of New York, and he would always tell them to buy buildings that were in foreclosure, and my Uncle Joe would always say, "But we never bought." And so I think that's where they're looking at. They figured investing in real estate would have been a way so they wouldn't have to wake up at 6 o'clock in the morning and go work in the bakery, but I don't know what else they would have done.
Well, where did they put their money?
They invested in stocks and bonds. They had what I'd refer to as a buy and never sell philosophy, so that by the time I came around, I saw they had invested in companies like that had been long bankrupt, like Western Union, Pan Am, Penn Central, but they had also invested in some stocks like AT&T and IBM.
And they got upset when Penn Central went under.
Yes, that was in 1970, and they were talking about it. I didn't have a clue. I was 12 years old at the time. They were talking about it at the dining table, and I didn't get it. Nobody took the railroad to get to work. I didn't understand. And it was only years later when I saw the financial statements, the brokerage statements, when I saw a penny line entry for Penn Central.
Well, they still, even though they didn't sell, they accumulated a lot of money, and they also had bank accounts all over the place.
Yes. They would apparently, when I cleaned up the apartment, I found all these boxes that had never been opened. And apparently, and I remember it from when I was a kid, in the 1560s, you could open up a bank account, and you would get, depending on how much you invested, some kind of gift, some kind of Tupperware, some kind of glasses, anything, knives, cutlery. And that's why they invested in so many different bank accounts.
My guess is Mort Zachter, Z-A-C-H-T-E-R. His memoir is called Dough, and it's published by University of Georgia Press. There was debate within the family as to what your uncles did when they weren't working. Where do you think they were in the limited time that they had off?
Uncle Harry, obviously, he was a mystery wrapped in an enigma. He really, I would have loved after I found out all of this to speak to him when he still had his faculties. But basically, between making deposits in banks, in terms of picking up stuff and making deliveries, they delivered to restaurants in the area. And
so they were also wholesalers.
They were also wholesalers. I think that's how they made they could make more than a 1 or 2 penny markup. They had clients like the Second Avenue Deli for years. They would sell them rye bread. I found some papers that indicated my uncle had taken care of this old woman who lived a few blocks away, and based on the paperwork I found, had really taken very good care of her, and I was never able to find out exactly what the relationship with her and my uncles or even my grandparents were. So there's a lot of questions that I'll never have answers for.
Well, he took care of her, but he didn't take care of his own family.
That's right.
When did you become aware of this fortune?
I became aware of this in the summer of 1994. I was 36 years old. It was 1 week after I took the bar exam. I'd gone to law school for 4 years at night, accumulated student loans, worked very hard. In the middle of that period, I had lost my job. I was working. I started my own firm as a CPA, working out of a bedroom in my office, in my house.
And you'd gone to Brooklyn College because it was less expensive than other schools?
That's right.
Brooklyn's is a good school, but still.
Right. I didn't even take the SAT. My parents, you know, basically said, that's a school we can send you to, and that's where I went. I even had a Regents scholarship, so basically that paid for my books.
So what do you... You must have been very upset when you realized that you could have gone to a really good school without having to worry about it. You wouldn't have had all those student loans.
I think I took out student loans when I was in law school. But what I worked through eventually, and I think this is one of the reasons why the book took me so long to write. It took me almost 5 years to write. As I worked through a lot of that anger, the initial feeling was one of elation, like, wow, I'm going to, within a few, you know, some period of time, I'm going to lose the natural age, inherit a lot of money. But afterwards, this remorse came in and said, well, my life could have been different. My mother could have had a completely different life. But in the end, ultimately, I think I learned to forgive. And there's a wonderful line that appeared in a review that was in the Los Angeles Times of my book a few weeks ago by a woman named Diana Lenny. And it said that when it comes to people we love, they're on the short list of people who can spit in our eye and we can look up and say, it's raining.
But your father waited until he was very ill and in the hospital to finally tell you about the money. He obviously loved you. Why would he have kept that for you?
I think in his case, he felt it wasn't his money. And he was just, at that point, the keeper of the money because my Uncle Harry had lost capacity. The money was
technically... He had Alzheimer's. And he was living with you.
Right. He was living with my parents. At that point, I was married. I had my own family. I lived in Long Island. But my Uncle Harry went to live with my parents. And he actually slept in the last couple of years of his life in the same bed that I grew up with his head next to the refrigerator.
Now, he had enough money to have been able to get the best nursing home care possible.
Right. At the very end of his life, he eventually went into nursing home, and he got very good care there. But unfortunately, it was the end of his life, and he could have had a much better life.
Have you heard of similar cases of people accumulating vast sums of money but choosing to live in poverty?
Yes. It's not, believe it or not, you hear about it every once in a while. Usually it's a single man who's had a mundane job, had enough brains to invest in IBM and would reinvest the dividends, and then they pass away and you hear about a huge sum left to a charity. New York had a very famous case, the Collier brothers, who passed away in 1947 in this house that... if you're an old-timer in New York, people still remember. It was just chock full of things like cars and pianos.
But your experience seems to be the reverse of what we think of as the typical child or grandchild of immigrants.
Right.
They work really hard so their kids can have.
Right. It's the opposite. And I think you have to segregate here what my uncle's viewpoint was and what my parents were. And I think my parents were highly influenced by my uncle, but they themselves wanted the best of me. But in a way, because they had been products of the New York City public school system and my mother went to Hunter College, CUNY was good enough. So I went to Brooklyn College, part of the CUNY system. But there is that unusual dichotomy there, yes.
I'm assuming your uncles didn't do any estate planning.
No.
So what happened when they died? Did the federal government get the big share of this?
The federal government got the big share of the money. They got 50% of the money. And it's the irony is that for that point in time, I was a CPA and a tax attorney. I was practicing doing wills and estate planning for people, yet they never consulted me, so there was no chance to do any kind of estate planning. And the other sad thing is they could have made a huge gift to charity, but they never did anything like that.
Was it apparent that you would be the person who inherited this money?
Yes, it was kind of clear because they had no lineal descendants and I was the only one from the next generation.
Would it be indiscreet to ask how much you wound up with?
You can ask. It was about, after taxes, was somewhere around $3 million.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's... It could have been a lot more as
right.
well, and you probably would have given a fair amount to charity.
I did do some things for charity on a substantial level, but I could have done more had they done some planning. But I'm not complaining. I'm a very lucky man.
Well, the money, I'm sure, has changed your life. But once you're set in your ways, you don't suddenly start drinking a lot of champagne and eating a lot of caviar, do you?
That's true. I drive a Honda. I'm no slave to fashion, as you could probably see. And I say the great thing I'm doing for myself is probably that I've dedicated myself to what I always wanted to be, a writer. I wrote this book. I'm working on another book now about Gil Hodges. And that's what I hope to do for the rest of my life, is write.
Many people, when they get a lot of money, suddenly change their politics and other things.
I'm still a registered Democrat. I vote Democratic. And though when I saw the amount of estate taxes that would have to be paid, there was a moment there where I said, my gosh, estate taxes should be done away with. And you would think I was from one of the red states. But I still hold firm. And
Doe is based on your essay, The Boy Who Didn't Live Money.
Didn't Like Money.
Didn't Like Money, which was nominated for a Pushcart Prize
right.
in 2006. And then you decided to expand it into a full memoir?
Right. Actually, it's funny. I had wrote this book in different drafts over the years, and finally someone said to me, and I couldn't even get a literary agent, and then finally someone said to me, why don't you write it as a short piece of 5,000 words or less and try and get it published? And that's exactly what I did, and a wonderful literary journal called Fourth Genre published it, and it was, they subsequently nominated for the Pushcart.
And, of course, then it's a lot easier to sell it to a publisher after that.
It actually, no one still wanted to buy it. The only reason my book got published was because it won a literary contest, something called the Association of Writers and Writing Programs, which is the consortium of all the MFA programs in the U.S. They take in submissions in poetry, fiction, and nonfiction. In 2006, my book was the one out of thousands picked in the category of nonfiction.
Who runs the bakery these days?
A very nice Ukrainian couple. Oleg and Titania, they're wonderful people. I've befriended them over the years. I've since the book came out, I've been back there a number of times. And this is the book actually is helping them and spur some customers coming in and more recognition.
Because the neighborhood has changed so much.
Right, and the bakery is still run the same way. They don't bake. They have a lot less wholesalers to buy from. And the neighborhood, yes, it has changed. People, it's no longer quite as Ukrainian as it was. And the number of people who... like babka has gone down over the years.
You mean you can't convince all of those gentrified tenants to like babka? Everybody
I
loves babka.
If they tried the chocolate babka, I think they would not worry about their waistline for the moment.
Mort Zachter has moved out of the New York area, now lives in beautiful Princeton, and has written a book called Doe. It's the memoir of his experiences as somebody who had no idea that he was incredibly rich. The book published by the University of Georgia Press. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you, Leonard.